Today, we're going to talk about the Gulf oil disaster. Let me ask the big question first. Just because we have the technological know-how and the financial incentive to tap into a huge and powerful stream of crude oil a mile under the ocean and pull that oil up through that ocean to the surface, does that in any way mean we should do it? How is it that we humans do such things? How is it that this society at this moment is willing to act with such hubris and arrogance and so little care and wisdom? Nearly 20 weeks ago, on April 20th, an explosion on BP's Deepwater Horizon drilling rig sent over 50,000 barrels of oil a day gushing into the Gulf of Mexico, the largest marine oil spill in history. I'm going to speak today with Rick Steiner, who's been working on these issues in Alaska and beyond for 30 years. We're going to talk about oil spill prevention, response, assessment, and restoration. Steiner learned about oil spills the hard way in Valdez Harbor. He also learned about academic politics the same way, losing federal grant funding for outspoken criticism of the oil industry. Steiner believes the most important story here is not actually about oil, it's about what comes after oil and how seriously and how fast we move toward that future. Let me just give a quick quote from Steiner. The transcendent take-home lesson from all of this is that we need to hasten our transition to sustainable energy. Some of the costs of oil becomes very clear in oil spills, but the real costs also include climate change, wars to secure oil supplies, health impacts from breathing atmospheric emissions, and supporting petrodictators. We know we need to transition to sustainable, clean, low-carbon energy, and we know how. We know that the chronic day-to-day degradation of our biosphere caused by our oil addiction, global warming, ocean acidification, coral reef death, sea level rise, floods, droughts, crop failure, forest fires, ice melt, biodiversity loss, is cumulatively more devastating than all the oil spills we can throw at ourselves. The only real way to atone for the Deepwater Horizon disaster is to kick our disastrous oil habit and become better stewards of our endangered home planet. We'll see if we learn that lesson this time around. Rick Steiner served as a marine conservation professor with the University of Alaska from 1980 to 2010. Stationed in the Arctic, Prince William Sound, and Anchorage. He was responsible for the university's conservation and sustainability extension effort. He was producer-host of the Alaska Resource Issues Forum, a public television program on controversial natural resource issues. He advised the emergency response to the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989 and helped found the Regional Citizens Advisory Councils and the Prince William Sound Science Center. He currently and has for years advised the UN, governments, NGOs, and industry on oil spill prevention, response, assessment, and restoration. Welcome, Rick Steiner. I notice you did your college work in Tennessee. How did you end up in Alaska? And then how did you end up focused on these two opposing forces, oil and water?
Well, I guess somewhat by default on the latter part, but my passion all along, I grew up around Washington, D.C., was to sort of seek out those wild and unspoiled places in the world. I was an ecology graduate from the University of Tennessee, and the first thing I wanted to do once I got out of there was go to Alaska, and that was in the mid-70s, right as the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was being built, and the whole face of Alaska was changing then. And then I moved there after graduate school and took up various jobs, fishing, working for the state of Alaska, and then with the university. And then, of course, when I was at the university's marine advisor for Prince William Sound, the Exxon Valdez occurred. And I had been involved in offshore oil and energy and environment issues for years and teaching workshops on it. And this one, you know, we knew there was a possibility of it. But I think we were all caught off guard by the thing. So anyway, that's sort of what drug you kicking and screaming into these issues.
Right. And I'm going to mention with something which I emailed you early during the week. We may well have met in 1989. I spent a week sleeping on Kelly Weaverling's couch. He was the guy who headed up the wildlife protection volunteer effort. And I interviewed fishermen and what were called then spillionaires, the folks who'd made more money that summer cleaning up hired by Exxon to clean up and perhaps keep them from being angry that summer, for a movie that I want to write about the fishermen's response to the Exxon spill, because they really saw that the government was and the oil company was not doing what was needed. and sailed with a flotilla of boats that went from Cordova to Valdez at the end of the summer, sort of to mark that, you know, we're still here. And I couldn't sell the movie. Bigger names with more, you know, more credibility got the deals. Were you on that flotilla?
I was not on that particular flotilla, but yeah, the day one of the oil spill, from my office in Cordova, I jumped on a plane and went up to Valdez and walked through the Exxon Command Center doors. They were set up at a little hotel there in Valdez, and nobody had bothered to walk in and say hi to them. And they asked who I was. I told them. We started talking. And so very soon, a few of us from Cordova were put into the emergency command team with the Coast Guard, the state of Alaska, and Exxon, because, you know, as well-intentioned as some of them may have been, they knew nothing about Prince William Sound, about
right.
what was possible, what was not, those places that we needed to really desperately protect as much as possible, and those that unfortunately could be sacrificed. So we became front and center in the emergency response.
Well, I know that, for instance, I think the fishermen actually found the booms were not
yeah.
arriving on time, and they went out and contracted themselves and had some shipped in because the government and Exxon weren't getting them in quick enough.
Yeah, it was total calamity, total chaos. And so that gets back to the promises that were made by the pipeline company, Alyeska, prior to this. They had a oil spill contingency plan that really wasn't worth the paper it was written on. Very similar to the Gulf of Mexico, which we'll get to here in
yeah,
a little
exactly.
bit.
Yeah, exactly. Just to set it up for listeners, what I do want to do is, before we wade into the Gulf, let's
yeah.
talk about oil in Alaska and the Exxon Valdez, because there's, in some senses, a deja vu. I mean, there were some people that probably 1989 with the terribly hot summers of 88 and 89 and then the Exxon Valdez spill kind of woke up to the environment at that point, and then here we go years and years later, the magnitude is worse, the needs are more desperate, and so on. So I want to, because you were there, and because it gives us sort of a background, Exxon Valdez, what happened, why did it happen, what were the consequences, and what did we learn?
Well, basically, it was a fully loaded supertanker, what's called the VLCC, a very large crude carrier owned by Exxon Shipping Company. It was a brand new boat, only 2 years old, the star of the fleet. All the electronics were great and everything. They did not have an autopilot alarm on board, which now most tankers do. And so the captain and some others had been across the bay while the tanker was being loaded at the terminal, which takes, you know, half a day or so. They'd have been across the bay drinking and got back on the vessel late in the evening on the 24th of March, actually on the 23rd of March, 1989, and sailed out Valdez Harbor with a full load of oil. And the skipper left it under, he asked, there was some ice from the Columbia Glacier that had come into the shipping lanes. And so Captain Hazelwood requested of the Coast Guard there permission to deviate from the outbound lane across the inbound lane, sort of like a highway. They have a right-hand side and a left-hand side.
Sure.
So stay in the lane, right?
Yeah, I mean.
And so he asked permission to deviate left to the east across the inbound lane and even out of that to avoid ice in the shipping lane. Perfectly reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But then he left the bridge in command of Greg Cousins, a third mate, who did not have pilot credentials for Prince William Sound, and apparently didn't really know what he was doing. And so Hazelwood went below into his stateroom. They continued steaming straight ahead towards Bligh Reef. And then Cousins gave a command to the helmsman to turn back right to the starboard into the shipping lanes. Yet what happened, evidently, was they left it on autopilot, and they didn't know that. And so even though they gave the helm command to turn back into the shipping lanes, this fully loaded single-hulled supertanker was heading full steam straight towards Bligh Reef, and it was dark at night, you know, it was right around midnight. They didn't notice that. They should have. The warning lights were on the wrong side of the vessel. By the time they caught it, they started turning to the starboard, but it was too late, and they ground straight headlong, full speed ahead, right into Bligh Reef. About something like, it's difficult to know exactly how much oil came out, but it all came out within about a six-hour period. On one low tide, we have about a 25-foot tide in Prince William Sound. So the ruptured tanks emptied most of their oil within just one tidal cycle. So that's very different from the Deepwater Horizon.
Right. Let me just tell people, by the way, in case you're saying, am I having a flashback here, a deja vu? Since Rick is from Alaska and was very involved in the post-Exxon Valdez spill, starting with that, and then we'll see what lessons we should have learned, which ones we did, and so on. So, as you were saying, you were pointing to the contrast between the spill that in Exxon Valdez happened very quickly, there it is, now deal with it, versus the gusher that erupted in the Gulf.
Very different, and let me just complete the Exxon Valdez scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So 40 to 50,000 tons, 250,000 barrels of this toxic Alaska North Slope crude oil came out in this one tidal cycle, spread southwest through Prince William Sound, a lot outside into the Gulf of Alaska, down past Kodiak Island, over onto the Alaska Peninsula. It ultimately oiled over something like 10,000 square miles of Alaska's coastal ocean. It ended up on about 1,200 miles of formerly pristine beaches and shorelines within the region, national parks, wildlife refuges, indigenous people's lands, state parks, etc. And the enormous acute mortality was something like 250,000 birds, several thousand marine mammals, countless intertidal invertebrates and such. And the damage to this day, 21 years later, is still evident. Most of the injured fish and wildlife populations that were injured by the oil spill have still yet to fully recover. Some, like Pacific herring and pigeon guillemots, a small seabird, are listed by the government independent science as not recovering at all. 21 years later, there are still some oil in the beaches from the Exxon Valdez. We knew that would be there. So the take-home lesson is, these things, if they happen in the wrong place at the wrong time, a lot of major oil release into a productive coastal marine environment can cause extraordinary short-term and long-term damage to ecosystems, cultures, social systems, and economies.
Very good. Thank you, Rick Steiner. It's interesting. My question, why did it happen? I've never heard the description. And even back then, I didn't get how clearly it was. I hadn't heard the autopilot piece of that and so on. That was one where that looks like, you know, human error on the level of Hazelwood's dereliction of his duty, Cousins' inability to perform, so on. So it looks in some senses less egregious on a large scale than what happened in the Gulf. But were there other things, like the fact that it wasn't double-hulled and other things that could have, in other words, you go, oh, we shouldn't have captains go below when they're still in the channel. That would be an obvious lesson, but were there others?
Absolutely. Your point is right on the head, and it's we have to be able to anticipate all the system failures that can lead to a disaster or a catastrophic oil release like this. And in the Exxon Valdez, you needed, in all the tanker system in Prince William Sound, you needed to be able to anticipate the 1,001 ways things can go wrong and then put in system redundancies, checks and balances in the system so that if any of them do go wrong, there's, you know about it and you can correct it in time before to prevent a disaster. So, for instance, double-hull tankers would have reduced the outflow by about half or relatively about that. A better vessel traffic system where the Coast Guard was actually monitoring the vessel out there and knew that they were headed full.
Right. I mean, here you have a case. Here you have a case, as you described, where someone had asked for permission to deviate. So you think at that moment the Coast Guard reacts differently than normal and says, okay, we're going to keep an eye on this one.
Absolutely, they should have been, but the radar system had been downgraded. They couldn't see the vessel with their radar out where it was headed towards Bligh Reef. So that got fixed. The other thing that got fixed now, of course, we have all double-hull tankers in and out of Alaska. They have double escort tugs escorting every loaded tanker out to the ocean entrance of Prince William Sound so that, and they have three functions. One is to make darn sure that the tanker stays in the tanker lanes where it's supposed to be safely. Two, if it breaks down, loses engine power or rudder or something like that, they're standing by to be able to hook up a tow real quickly to pull it from shore. And thirdly, if there is a spill, they have immediate spill response equipment on board. So the escorts, the better vessel traffic monitoring, better bridge watch protocols, alcohol screening before tankers get on the tanker and leave, disembark from Port Valdez. All those things got worked out pretty well after the Exxon Valdez.
After.
The point here is that, you know, there are 1,001 ways that these catastrophic oil releases can occur, and you have to anticipate all of them effectively in order to be able to do this kind of business safely. So the only thing we really fixed out of Exxon Valdez was tanker safety.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get that transcendent lesson of sustainable energy. And you know, look back to 1969 and the Santa Barbara blowout. You know, people were just starting to get the message of climate change then. That's when it just started to come, an environment that were causing systemic environmental damage to the biosphere, the planet as a whole. In 1970, you know, the first Earth Day right after Santa Barbara, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and
creation of the EPA.
Policy Act and creation of EPA, all this kind of stuff happened. So there was a sort of a step, a leap, a quantum leap in environmental consciousness, but we didn't get to sustainable energy because oil was so cheap. Exxon Valdez, 20 years later, same thing. We knew we needed to transition to sustainable energy, low-carbon energy, but again, oil was so cheap right after that that there was no immediate financial incentive, and therefore there was no political motivation to do it, so we didn't get there. And here we are now, 2010, Deepwater Horizon, and I think the real tragedy out of this thing will be in 10 years, or 10 or 20 years if we look back on it, and the only thing we've achieved is safer offshore drilling regulations and better government oversight and better oil spill response plans. That's something, but it's not enough. And, you know, if we miss this opportunity to really hasten the transition to sustainable energy, we may really be missing our last best chance to do such.
Right. It seemed to me it was interesting. You said the transcendent lesson was, of course, we have to curb our addiction to oil. I thought you were going to say the previous one, because it seems to me two of them really are, in other words, there's all the specifics, and then there is the anticipation of risk, anticipation of worst-case scenarios, and the redundancy to take care of that, because clearly with the Deepwater Horizon, sure, we all know we're digging a mile under the Gulf because we haven't made the shift. But
right.
We also had gotten really careless. And it seems to me, you know, it seems so, as I said in my introduction, you know, how is this even possible that a society, you know, the Exxon Valdez is a large tanker, you know, and human error. This one is attempting things that it seems to me are what happens if something goes wrong.
Right.
When you're pumping a mile down. I mean, as I listened to some of the descriptions over the last 120 days of what they were actually doing technologically, it's both phenomenally impressive, and it just seems you cannot have that hubris without equal parts of prudence.
Absolutely, precisely true. We've been pushing the envelope on energy, on oil and gas production for years. We've used, by most geological estimates, we have used approximately half of all the available producible oil in the Earth's crust, about 1 trillion barrels over the last century. And so they think there may be less, but there may be about 1 trillion barrels left. So we're right at or near peak oil right now.
Right.
And so all the easy stuff we've already produced, burned, and used in our phenomenally inefficient economies. Now they're reaching out into these more extreme environments, including the deep ocean and the Arctic, to satisfy this lust that we haven't been able to contain in any way, shape, or form. And all these things, we're asking a lot of technology. You know, these techno-wonks say we can do it safely. What they're saying is there is a marginal risk of a catastrophe like a Deepwater Horizon. And, you know, the administration knew this well before this. Everybody knew this. There have been catastrophic offshore blowouts. There was the Ixtoc blowout in the Gulf of Mexico in 1979. There was the Fadiwa 5 blowout in the late 70s and off of Nigeria. There was the Ekofisk blowout in the North Sea in the early 80s. So these things, there was the Monterra platform blowout just last year off of northwestern Australia. So we know these things happen. For President Obama, just weeks before the Deepwater Horizon blowout, to come in front of the nation and say, you know, most people don't realize, but offshore oil rigs generally don't cause oil spills. And either he was misinformed catastrophically by his aides, or somebody blew it.
Yeah, well, you know, let's just talk about that for a second, because in some sense, that's you know, that's water over the bridge. Obviously, everything's being reassessed right now. But what went into that, I cannot believe he was misinformed, because it's a very big decision, and it's a big decision for a progressive, a Democrat, etc. So my guess is that there was, the research was there. One of my guests a few weeks ago pointed out, and I thought this was both ironic and sad, that if we didn't have the abuse of filibuster in the Senate, that he probably wouldn't have done that.
He wouldn't have needed to make
exactly.
The deal with the
devil. In other words,
to offer offshore oil to get a climate and energy bill.
You are with me on that, exactly.
Absolutely.
That this was a political calculation, not an environmental or a safety calculation or an energy calculation. Political calculation. I will give certain senators that I need, because I need 60, not 51, because of the inability for that system to function. I will give them more offshore drilling, hopefully nothing goes wrong, in exchange for some sort of an energy bill. And you know, you just see how these various systems that we have that are not working interact.
That's right. And the political process, I mean, that one nuance of the U.S. Senate rules really needs to get changed to majority rule, so that there can be progress in Congress, and there really hasn't been, where a minority can actually restrict progressive policy. And, you know, if the guys in Congress, the folks in Congress that don't understand the energy environment crisis that we're in, and that the solution is not to drill our way out, but it's to conserve and find alternatives, that's the ultimate solution, and we need to get there, and we need to start yesterday, not tomorrow. If they don't get that at this point, then we have a very, very serious problem.
Yeah, and I by the way, would not be so kind as to say that they don't get it. My observation from where I sit is that there's a you know, that our system is so compromised with money that you have the people who actually you have a certain percentage of folks in the Senate who see what needs to be done and are willing to do it, whatever the politics.
Right.
Then you have a certain percent which don't give a damn what needs to be done and are just doing the work of whoever they're working for, and it is not their constituents, it is their funders. And then you have a group of people in the middle, which is where the failure really happens, who know better, but basically do the work of their funders and end up, as I say so often on the show, negotiating with themselves at every turn and failing both their constituents, their country, and their legacy ultimately by weakening things when, you know, nature bats last. You know, you cannot pretend just because some funder of yours believes something to be so that it is so.
That's right. Yeah, we have to check our understanding of things and where that derives. You know, that this all comes to what I see already from the administration, the oil industry, and a lot of folks, some folks in the United States and elsewhere, is this political scar tissue already forming over the Deepwater Horizon disaster, and saying, look, there's not much oil left, the damage isn't as bad as we thought, or as some said. Let's move on. Let's lift the moratorium. Well, you know, a lot of people were arguing to lift the deepwater drilling and Arctic drilling moratorium even while the thing was still blowing out. That shows how deep-rooted our addiction is. That is the most imprudent course, and it would have been. So more power to the administration for keeping the moratorium in place for right now, but they are desperate to lift it. We know this.
Yep. And by the way, it's two addictions. It's the addiction to oil and the addiction to corporate money.
Precisely, and power. And the preserving that status quo seems to be their marching orders. But before they lift any moratorium, they need to do several prudent steps.
But I'll tell you what, I want to get to that, but I do want,
sure.
we're very close to the half of the hour here. I want to get a brief, and I'm impressed so far with how you did it on Valdez, a brief account from where we sit now of what happened and why it happened, and then we'll go on from there. Let me just ask one last question about oil. What is the state of the oil industry and drilling and the Arctic refuge and all those things in Alaska as of this moment?
Well, the industry and the state government and even to some extent the federal government are gung-ho behind opening the entire offshore in the Arctic Ocean to oil and gas drilling. They're taking it slow because of Deepwater Horizon on the offshore, OCS drilling. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, there's a movement to put that in permanent wilderness status, the coastal plain, which I certainly support, and keep it off drilling, off limits to drilling. However, west of Prudhoe Bay, which is the largest oil field in North America right now that's been producing for 30 years, west of Prudhoe Bay is another large area called the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. It's technically the Central Arctic Coastal Plain. The administration has let them start exploratory drilling and such there. So there is going to be some additional onshore oil and gas exploration and drilling in Alaska and the Arctic, some offshore and nearshore and further offshore drilling. There's no question about that. The big issue in Alaska right now is building a gas line down to either Valdez or into Canada, and that will probably be done here in the near-term future. And that's a $30 billion project on par with the oil pipeline that was built 30 years ago. So that's kind of the lay of the land.
Okay, thank you very much. And by the way, for people who don't know it, Alaska is basically an oil state. And for whatever Sarah Palin and her ilk say about their hardy, grisly lives.
It's oil.
Well, and it's not just that. It's a socialist state because the government distributes to every, I believe it's every man, woman, and child, a
right.
check every year based on the oil receipts.
Based on the earnings for the permanent fund. The permanent fund was a good idea to sort of salt
sure.
that money aside.
Yeah.
But regardless, yeah, Alaska's budget, the state budget, is about 90% derived from oil revenues, and that drives the politics in Alaska.
Let's talk just very briefly about, as we pivot to the Gulf, about your experience with the University of Alaska. As I have it, you resigned from your tenured professorship to protest the university's decision to strip you of a NOAA grant. That's what are those abbreviations again? What's that acronym?
National Oceanic and Atmospheric.
Right, a federal agency,
agency
that had been granting you because of your outspoken opposition to oil drilling in Alaska's Bristol Bay. The university wrote that if a recipient of grant funding uses his position and his time to advocate for or against a particular development project, the funding agency may have a legitimate concern. As you say, Alaska gets 90% of its, the state of Alaska, and thus the university gets 90% of its funds from the oil industry. What happened, Rick?
Well, that was basically it. I have for 20 or 25 years, actually for 30 years, a significant part of my academic portfolio was teaching about energy and offshore oil, offshore environment, marine conservation issues, and particularly after Exxon Valdez, I was quite vocal about the need to prevent these sorts of things, better respond to them, transition to sustainable energy, better federal and state policy on that. And I've been doing that for years, and finally they sort of had enough, and I criticized them about their support for oil drilling, offshore oil drilling.
Their support being the university's support?
The university's support and ostensibly NOAA's support. This was a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then they terminated my federal funding because of that. They wrote me. They were very overt and open about why they did that. And I was theoretically protected by this concept called academic freedom, where I'm supposed to seek and teach my truth without fear or favor and fear of reprisal. Yet they did not honor that. We filed a grievance. That was overturned, and so then out of protest, I resigned. It was the only honorable thing that I could do. And subsequently, I was raising concerns about the risks of such things as catastrophic blowouts from offshore oil development in a very, very rich ecosystem in southwest Alaska called Bristol Bay. And subsequently, the federal government agreed, and they pulled that lease off the table. So they agreed that that place was too precious to expose to the risk of offshore oil. And this was long before Deepwater Horizon, yet the university went ahead and stumbled over themselves, pandering to oil company interests. They wanted to put my head on their wall, and they did. They succeeded, and that's fine. But the sad part of it is that it shows that university faculty are really not free to seek and teach their truth in Alaska if it is contradictory to the current political status quo and political ideology of resource development in Alaska, and that is a very troubling revelation.
Very good. The point you are making is that you actually resigned a tenured professorship.
That's right.
In the face of this.
That
they pulled the grant from, they actually followed that advice ultimately.
That's right. Yeah, they pulled the grant, and they told me it was specifically because of my public comments that were critical of offshore oil risks in Bristol Bay. And then they started, you know, they excluded me from certain meetings with oil companies and started messing around with me in other ways, terminated my office lease, for instance. And, yeah, I mean, some really childish maneuvers. But I understand where their egos got mixed up in this and you know, that they were simply pandering to the strong, overwhelming oil politics.
Very good. Okay,
so
now let's move that. Let's move to the Gulf. It's been over 4 months, and on this show, we only dealt with it once, a couple of weeks after it happened. With the advantage of some time and perspective, I'd like to look at several aspects. First, what happened?
Yeah.
How and why did it happen? And then consequences and lessons. But what actually happened? And how likely was what happened to happen?
Well, it is unfortunately likely. You know, it's what we call a low probability, high consequence event. We need to plan for them. You know, even if it's a 0.1% possibility that such a thing will happen, if it has a catastrophic consequence like Exxon Valdez or the Deepwater Horizon or the Space Shuttle Columbia or something like that, we need to plan for every eventuality and reduce those risks to zero as much as possible. The Deepwater Horizon is like many industrial disasters. It was a combination of human error and equipment failure. They were in a rush to plug and abandon this exploratory well. This is a high pressure reservoir they found, the Macondo Reservoir. Very deep water, very deep reservoir, so a lot of pressure. They were late. They'd had a number of shutdowns and problems, and they'd had gas kicks before. They didn't use enough centralizers when they put the drill pipe down to make sure that the pipe was centered in the well casing.
Now let me just stop you for a second, because those two things, that you called
gas kicks.
I've heard them as burps.
The well pipe, yeah,
right.
Which is a sign that you've got a problem in what they call well control. That's a very dangerous situation. You can't afford to have methane and natural gas blowing up a drilling pipe in an uncontrolled situation, which is one of the reasons they use all these very heavy synthetic drilling muds down in the well to try to keep that gas down in the reservoir.
So what you're saying is that
they were in a rush to plug and abandon this thing, right? And so they pulled all the mud out. There were problems in well design and how the centralizers, and they didn't use a lockdown sleeve where the drill pipe in the seabed came up to the blowout preventer. They didn't use a casing liner down at the bottom of the well. There were a number of problems.
Now, let me ask a couple of questions about that. Those three things you just mentioned, which was not enough vigilance about the escaping gas, two, the centralizers, which actually center the thing and mean that you don't have openings of different sizes on different sizes of your well.
When you do the cementing, you don't have a thin spot.
Right. And then the other thing you said about not using the top equipment, so on. How many – those things, it seems to me – all were financial considerations, where saving money overrode safety. Were any of them in violation of regulation or law?
Well, you know, I think some were. They're certainly in violation of best practice,
sure.
Even the American Petroleum Institute best practice. But I am not familiar with exactly what the regulations required of them. There were a number of anomalies in their daily drilling reports that they were reporting back that go to then was MMS, Minerals Management Service. So there should have been active intervention by the federal oversight agency.
And there were some red flags or yellow flags were going up on something where, as we've said, the risk may be low, but the effects are catastrophic.
Enormous. Yes, yeah. Even for the obviously, unfortunately, for the workers on board,
sure.
We tragically lost 11 lives there. But there were some other problems, too, where some guy accidentally hit a lever while they were testing the blowout preventer, and the annular seal, which is kind of a rubber gasket, sealed around the well as a test. Some guy accidentally backed into a lever up in the drill well on the rig and raised the pipe, and so some of the rubber annular seal broke, and so they were getting chunks of rubber up the drill stem, weeks before this thing. So there were a number of problems, and they knew they were doing a test that night on the Deepwater Horizon. But there were four officials from Transocean and BP out on the rig, VIPs taking a tour, and so they were more attentive to make. And those guys were out there celebrating their success. Their successful drilling of this well and their safety record, ironically, their safety record and everything. And so the workers in the drilling floor of the rig were a little distracted, and they didn't pay adequate attention to some of these signals they were getting that there was an imminent disaster ready to unfold. So we don't know all the details, but we know that there was a series of human error, poor judgment, poor decisions made in a rush to save money and save time.
Yeah, let me just point out to people, when he said several times they were in a rush to get this thing kept, the point is they were paying $500,000 a day, $500,000 a day to rent.
To lease, yeah.
To lease this rig. And if you can, what they did was, this was one where they find a source. They build down. They get their thing set up, and then they temporarily cap it, and remove the rig. And now the company that owns the rig goes and rents it somewhere else, and they're now free of that $500,000 a day while they decide when and how they're going to actually pull the oil up in the future.
That's right.
And so
that's
this
right.
was,
right.
and it was at that moment. In that rush to save $500,000, that the tragedy happened.
Right. And they didn't. They were putting in cement plugs into the well stem there, and they only had one end. They were getting ready to put the second one in, but they had all taken all the mud out of the well, which they shouldn't have done. Put seawater in, and so there was really no redundancy and safety valve in that system for a gas kick, which is what happened.
And they'd had gas kicks before.
Up to the well, to the rig, and it sort of, blew out for like several hundred feet high, apparently, a lot of mud and gas. And then there was an ignition source. We don't know exactly what that was, but then it ignited and exploded. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Right. It happened because we do these very risky things, because we've used all the easy-to-get-to oil, and we have not slaked our thirst in any means, but with developing countries coming on board, in fact, our appetite for oil globally is greater than ever, while the oil that we're trying to get is more difficult to get, more risky, etc. And then we have companies that were taking cutting corners and saving a dollar here and $1 million there, and then we have regulators. We had seen in the last days of the Bush administration revelations about some of the agencies involved here, that they were not doing their job and that had not been corrected yet in the Obama administration. And then we have human error, and then we have – but basically, it all goes back to that question I raised at the very start. When something is this – when the as you say, the consequences can be catastrophic as a society, not just as a company or as a government, as a society, we should be behaving differently. That's pretty much what happened?
Absolutely. And there's a concept in systems theory called suboptimization, which the way I understand that is – doing in the best possible way something that should never be done at all. So no matter how safe we make offshore oil drilling in deep water, high pressure reservoirs, in the Arctic Ocean, in these very extreme environments that are precious environments and the consequences of a blowout could be catastrophic, no matter how safe we make it, there will still be a risk of catastrophe, and therefore from a policy standpoint, do we need to be doing that? We need to be much more cautious about making those decisions. Maybe this is a good time to go back quickly to what needs to happen before any moratorium is lifted.
Go ahead.
One is they need a blowout risk assessment that analyzes and identifies 101 ways that these things can occur. Secondly, they need a better blowout risk prevention and mitigation system, and that includes, number one, a better blowout preventer with double redundant shear rams and better acoustic activation switching systems and such like that that can shut one of these well-controlled situations off at blowouts quickly. And also, thirdly, they need a better blowout response system, and the industry is designing something they call the Marine Well Containment System. That should have been designed years ago.
Well, it should have been designed before you dug wells a mile down.
Yeah. They, you know, BP went stumbling around after this thing trying to design everything from golf ball junk shots to big pollution containment chambers, and all this stuff should have been well engineered, designed, tested, and ready to go long before they were permitted to drill these high pressure offshore deep water reservoirs.
Yeah, let me.
So now they're doing it.
As a civilian looking out here, it looks to me like what probably and here, tell me again, what probably has happened has been everything has been gradual. In other words, we're digging in the ocean. You know, now we're digging deeper in the ocean. Now we're finding we've got the technology to allow us to dig even deeper, and so on. And each step along the way, we kind of move, and it becomes a little more dangerous, and the results, the consequences, a little more potentially catastrophic. Right. But it isn't like we went from, you know, something simple to something this dangerous. We moved slowly, and it's that tendency to not be precautionary, to not...
You mentioned the hubris of it, and, you know, we've gone... The offshore industry has convinced the politicians in this country and a lot of the public that this stuff, before this thing, can be done safely. Santa Barbara, you know, 40 years ago was an aberration, an anomaly. We've got it right after that, and people believed it. Some people did. You know, we didn't because we knew better, but... And here you get to this issue. I mentioned the space shuttle earlier. It's an interesting analogy here. After the Challenger disaster, which was caused by a very small, simple initial failure, the O-ring got too cold in the fuel tank, right? So the Challenger blows up. And so NASA goes through this enormous risk assessment of how these things happen. They fix that problem, but they did not anticipate the problem that caused the catastrophic explosion of the Columbia several years later on another launch, and that was the little chunk coming off the gantry and penetrating the insulation on one of the wings, causing a catastrophic disaster on reentry. So you can fix the exact problem that you identify caused one disaster and not really prevent the next disaster. So that's why they need to do a comprehensive look at the risks of offshore drilling. Let me also mention some of the companies, and I am loath to compliment this particular company called Exxon, but they had a field in the Gulf of Mexico, a deep water field several years ago called the Blackbeard Reservoir. They were drilling that, and you know what? Their engineers looked at this and they said they didn't like it. They got cold feet, and they said we should not be drilling this field, and they gave up on it. And hallelujah for them. that was tremendous. And but why didn't the federal government intervene and tell them to back away from that? And subsequently, they sold the field, and another company is trying to develop it now. So if a major, now safety-conscious company backs away from a reservoir because they think it's too tricky and too risky and too dangerous, it should be, that reservoir should be abandoned, should be taken off the
Right. In other words, they've voted with their money. I mean, they've been willing.
It's a billion-barrel field.
And the sunk costs.
Exactly.
Whatever they've spent getting there is what seems to lead so many of our politicians and our corporations to, well, it's gotten, you know, it looks bad, but we've already spent this. We got to go forward. Think about Iraq. Think about Afghanistan. This goes across our whole society. In other words, what happened on Wall Street, to me, is very similar to what happened in the Gulf. In other words, the consequences of catastrophe were so great that certain things shouldn't have been undertaken, and
they controlled it through deregulation. They convinced
the
government to deregulate the industry.
Exactly.
And look at what happened.
As a society, we depend on an analysis of risk and incentives that take into account risk and reward. And I would also throw in, you know, just the war in Iraq is another perfect example where the risk is completely not taken account of and the consequence is catastrophic. There's something very wrong with our society that it doesn't have this, you know, you'd think a parent would have this when they're looking at a child, and yet as a society we've lost risk and incentive completely.
It's irrational, really, when you think about it.
Yeah.
And when you look at the grand scheme of things, the degradation to the biosphere of the planet over the last 50 years, primarily, you realize that people are, you know, they're enjoying the profits from the natural world, but not assuming the social and environmental risks and degradation that sort of profit taking causes. And so that's something that's been going on for decades, and that needs to get intervened somehow.
If we did everything right now in terms of moving off of fossil fuels and moving toward conservation, efficiency, cleaner renewable energy sources, we're still going to, over the next few years, as rapidly as we transition, we're going to use more oil and coal. We've already said that we've reached peak oil, so that's why we're doing such dangerous things as we're doing and risking what we're risking. What is safe? Talk to me briefly about shale oil, natural gas, the way people are. What is safe today in terms of oil and gas?
Well, the biggest energy savings and resource we've got is energy efficiency.
Absolutely.
And we have been over the last, because we've been lazy and had low cost oil, theoretically low cost to us, immediate cost oil. We've been lazy, and there hasn't been motivation to go to more efficient energy systems. A good example is Japan and Western Europe produce a unit of economic output on about half the energy input that we do in the United States. And another way of looking at that then is that the U.S. is wasting at least half of the energy we're using today just with technologies that are on the shelf and being used elsewhere.
So, and as you say, we're wasting twice the total amount of the Deepwater Horizon spill every day.
Every day, that's right.
By inefficiency.
About 20 million barrels a day, a little bit less because of the recession.
And we're not talking, as you just pointed out, we're not talking about some enormous advances that no one's tried so far.
No, they're being used in
other countries.
And so what we need is for governments to provide what governments can provide, and that is subsidies to those things we want and taxes and costs imposed to those things we don't.
That's incentives again. Yep.
Yeah. And so if government can at least remove the subsidies from fossil fuels and start imposing start showing the cost, the true cost of oil, which includes climate change and environmental disasters like the Deepwater Horizon and health effects of breathing the stuff and instability, political instability in the world. Those true costs, there was an estimate done in the UK by a research outfit several years ago that showed that if you were to pay all the real costs of oil at the gas pump, you'd be paying $15 a gallon. So we need to impose a tax on carbon, collect that money, subsidize alternative and efficient, low-carbon, clean, safe energy resources. And, you know, everybody listening to this knows what those are. If we subsidize them effectively, they become cost-effective, and thus oil becomes less cost-effective. And it's inevitable. This is a finite resource. We are at or near, or some think even past, peak oil production, and it will go down. It's a finite resource. And so we're going to have to transition. We better start it sooner instead of having to rush into it later. But I see some positive signals out there that this could happen. But I hope the Deepwater Horizon disaster will help catalyze that sort of transition, because if we look at this thing years down the road and we haven't gotten there out of this, I become desperately worried about our possibilities for really forming that kind of sustainable society that we know is possible. So I'd be very worried about that.
Right. Now, I've got about another minute and a half with you, Rick, before I got to close.
Okay.
It's, you know, Amory Lovins obviously been talking about conservation and efficiency forever. I mean, what you're saying may be news to some people, but it's not news to the people who really have been studying this. Obviously, there's more money behind politicians to help me with my big oil company keep doing what I'm doing than there is for conservation or efficiency. What can listeners do?
Well, two things. One is sort of get right with yourself, you know, lead by example, live your life with as low an ecological footprint as you possibly can. And everybody knows how to do that with, you know, pre-cycling, don't buy stuff you don't need, recycle product, you know, packaging and things like that, walk, ride bikes, ride mass transit, you know, live your life in a more sustainable, low-impact manner, number one. But that is not going to get us
there. That's not going to do it.
And so the second thing that people need to do is get politically engaged and make their political systems that they're engaged with understand that they want this change. They're not going to accept the old status quo, that they have to change. We have to get a sustainable energy economy here within the next 10 years, or we are really foreclosing a sustainable future for human society. And so the notion of running for office, helping people get elected to office that understand this and will actually do something, and then holding those people that come into office accountable once they're there. You know, I voted for Barack Obama. I think he's probably one of the smartest presidents we've ever had. I think he's great. And where is the change that we can all believe in? You know, we need to all hold the administration and Congress accountable for this issue right here, right now. There needs to be an energy revolution in this country, in this world.
Okay, I've got to end it there. And let me just say to people, the state of California, in the wrap-up of legislature, failed to pass the acceleration of our renewable energy efforts, which would be so good for our economy as well as this question we're talking about. Thank you to Rick Steiner for this in-depth look at BP's Deepwater Horizon Gulf oil disaster. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to the podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for free. And you can hear it and sign up for it either at iTunes or at TerrenceMcNally.net, T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E, McNally, M-C-N-A-L-L-Y.net, or, if it's easier for you to remember, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. If you want to get my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about and giving you some background on the issues, on this one, I included three articles from Rick, BP Oil Disaster, Day 35, Day 60, and Day 109. That's what you'd have gotten if you signed up for that announcement. You can do that either on my website, TerrenceMcNally.net, or by emailing me at TEMcNally@Mac.com. TEMcNally@Mac.com. Thank you, Rick Steiner. Keep up the good work.